Hey, my name's Jamie Poisson, and I'm the host of Front Burner. It's the CBC's daily news podcast. And every day, we're discussing the big events and fault lines shaping Canada and the world. Politics, economics, social movements, you name it. Sometimes we even talk about really fun stuff, like the enduring relevance of Lord of the Rings. You can hear Front Burner on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
I'm Eleanor Wachtel, and this is Writers and Company from the Archives. Today, a two-part conversation with the Pulitzer Prize-winning Libyan-British writer Hisham Attar. His 2011 novel, Anatomy of a Disappearance, draws on his own story of his missing father. Hisham Attar's fiction is haunted by a sense of loss and displacement, but especially by the absence of a father. As the narrator in his 2011 novel says, right in the book's first paragraph, "There has not been a day since his sudden and mysterious vanishing that I have not been searching for him, looking in the most unlikely places." And while here Attar is writing fiction, a hit memoir, The Return, would come later, it's impossible to read his books without being aware of the shadow cast by his own experience. Hisham Attar was born in New York in 1970 to Libyan parents. In fact, his father was part of the Libyan mission to the United Nations at the time. But he resigned in 1973 when Colonel Muammar Gaddafi tore up the constitution and declared himself leader for life. That resignation, a sign of independence, marked him in Gaddafi's regime. And although the family returned to Tripoli, a few years later they realized they would be safer living outside of Libya. Eventually, they managed to escape to Cairo. 10 years later, in 1990, while Hisham Attar was studying in England, his father was abducted by the Egyptian security forces and handed over to the Libyans. He was tortured and imprisoned in Tripoli. After a few years, he managed to send a letter and an audio tape to his family. But the last time they heard from him directly was in 1995. Nowadays, Hisham Attar divides his time between London and New York, where he teaches at Columbia University. His passions originally were for poetry, music, and architecture. He even worked for a while in an architecture firm, but with the success of his first novel, In the Country of Men, he's devoted himself to writing, including political columns about his homeland, Libya. In the Country of Men won a lot of awards and was shortlisted for the Booker Prize. It focuses on a 9-year-old boy whose politically active father is tortured and imprisoned by the Libyan security forces. Although ultimately he's released, he's a broken man and dies soon after. The time is 1979 and the atmosphere is drenched with repression and fear and arbitrary arrests and executions. Hisham Attar's next novel, Anatomy of a Disappearance, also features the abduction of a dissident dad. But in this case, he doesn't come back, and his fate remains uncertain. Again, the story is told from the perspective of the son, but with very different emotional entanglements. I first spoke to Hisham Attar when he was in Toronto in 2011. I began by asking him about his childhood in Libya in the mid-1970s, living under Gaddafi's brutal dictatorship. Just a warning, some details of our conversation are disturbing.
My family were very good at sheltering my brother and I from what was going on. But still, you know, we noticed certain things. For example, I remember the day that the army trucks went to all of the old bookshops in Tripoli and collected basically everything and burnt it. They went to the music instrument shops and collected instruments and burnt them. There was these kind of sort of acts of euphoria, as if like there's a need to assert some kind of will.
Musical instruments. I mean, I can understand, unfortunately, books, but musical instruments?
Well, you know, suddenly somebody would say this is a sign of imperialism, that we have people having pianos and guitars and these Western instruments in their homes, and we should cleanse the country of these. So there was this sort of romanticism about the provinces that Gaddafi brought in, where anything of value was really the thing that was folkloric and traditional, that was valued. And anything else that was part of Libya's Mediterranean character, you know, Libya is not like Egypt. Not much grows there. So most people trade, and they trade with the outside world. And that has, over the centuries, influenced Libyan society and enriched it. And that's something that he resisted. I think, like many dictators, actually, they despise the city. They despise the university, the museums, the theater. You know, see it as sort of a wild animal that needs to be tamed and controlled and put on a leash. And that was so that was part of what was going on then.
And would you have had so-called dangerous books and instruments in your home?
One of the characteristics of dictatorship is that the only place where culture happens is in the home. All the theaters were closed in Libya. Every civic organization was dismantled. Everyone. It's extraordinary, actually. And so the only place you could go and listen to music or poetry or read books was the home, which is why the dictatorship employed the television to televise the interrogations and executions. It was a very clever way to enter that last private domain.
So they actually did that, because that is a feature in your first novel, In the Country of Men, that one of the most disturbing scenes is watching an execution on television. Did you actually see that as a child?
I mean, my protagonist sees it as a child. As I said, my parents were very good at that.
In terms of protecting you from that?
But I saw a video of it when I was in my late teens, and it affected me very deeply. It was a moment of national psychosis that was inflicted by the dictatorship. People were tricked into being the audience of something truly horrific that was unfolding in front of their eyes, and so they didn't really know how they're supposed to respond. And fear made them just...
complicit, in a sense.
Complicit and impotent. So, for example, they'll say, everybody come to the basketball stadium, and all these new stadiums that were constructed as part of the economic boom that happened in the early to mid 70s. And people would go thinking, you know, there's going to be some important event. And they turn up, and there is this panel of people, and there's a big curtain covering one side of the court. And people sit down, the doors are closed, so you can't get out. Suddenly, they bring some poor, wretched soul into the thing. They sit on the floor, and the panel starts questioning him, saying, "You've said this or you said that. You're a traitor." And suddenly, the curtain would come down, and you see this noose. And many Libyans remember the first time this happened. And I've spoken to several people who were in that stadium, and they describe this sense of shock and entrapment. They were being forced to be complicit. And this just sort of gained momentum. Certain characters that were doing this gained more and more and more power and influence because Gaddafi thought they were loyal to him. For example, in one such execution, the man that was hanged, that was done in such a kind of clumsy way that he didn't die. He was kicking in the air. And a member of the Revolutionary Committee, this woman went over to him and she hugged his legs and kept pulling until he died. Gaddafi thought this was fantastic, and he made her mayor of Benghazi. So there was this new sort of elite that was coming up that was gaining power through cruelty, and it changed dramatically the country. And so that was really around that time that we left.
Hisham Mater, the story of your family's escape from Libya is in some ways like something out of a thriller. I mean, your mother was pretending that she and your father were separated, that he was living abroad with a new family. Can you describe some of what went on that year before you were finally able to leave the country?
Whilst my father was on a trip abroad, his name appeared on one of these lists that the Revolutionary Committee would draft from time to time to sustain this kind of momentum. And so he was advised not to come back. And my parents embarked on kind of an amazing project where they pretended to everybody they knew, including their siblings and their children, my brother and I, that they were separated. So that would be the way that the Libyan government might let us out of the country, because they refused that we leave. So in effect, they held us hostage till father.
So that your father would return if his family was there.
Yeah.
So then they pretended that they were there. I didn't realize that they didn't even to their children, you and your older brother.
No, we didn't. No, for about a year this went on. And they couldn't speak, more importantly, my parents couldn't speak on the telephone.
In case the phone was tapped?
Well, the phone was definitely
tapped. It was tapped.
Yeah, no. No, I mean, this feeling that you are being observed all the time, you know, you can... There was a car outside. We would, wherever we would go, the car would follow us. And there was all this click in the phone. And I mean, I tried to use some of that in my novel, In the Country of Men, because there are so many things that you can point to, very clear things that illustrate the effects of dictatorship. You can point to the effects on education, on civic society, as I mentioned, all these things, and you could measure them. But there is this other thing that you can't measure, which is to do with a sense of anxiety that is inflicted on everybody. The sense that you are either going to betray or be betrayed. At any moment, these two possibilities are alive. And also the sort of lack of confidence that it inflicts on people. It's a very corrosive experience. So I was interested more in that rather than to give a geopolitical picture of what was going on. I'm more interested in how people love differently, or how do they love? How do they live under this?
But your parents were able to sustain their relationship, obviously, and
yes, no, we had a, you know, we eventually succeeded. My mother one day said to us, there's this, there's a, decorators are coming to the house, so take with you the most precious things. And I remember taking my, when I was 7 years old, my father bought me my first bottle of cologne. And it was a children's cologne. You know, you shake it and it bubbles up here, no? But I thought this was a sign of my manhood. I had a bottle of cologne. And so I took that and I took my favorite radio. And my brother took his medals because he was a very good swimmer and had won all these medals. So we obviously knew on some level because she said, we're going to the sea for a couple of weeks. Take the most precious things.
Yeah, and why would you take precious things?
Yeah. And she drove us straight to the airport, told us on the way, we're leaving, we're going to be reunited with Dad. This whole divorce thing is she explained everything. Then we started a new life in Egypt.
You described the time with your family in Cairo as a happy time, but life wasn't carefree exactly there. You had round-the-clock armed guards, and it was in Egypt that your father actually became more open in his opposition to the Gaddafi regime. Did this cause conflict within the family, that he was courting danger?
Yes, very much. We had very vigorous conversations about it. I mean, my mother, my brother, and I were on one side, my father was on the other side. He, you know, we wanted him to refrain from open opposition to the Gaddafi regime because it was a very dangerous business. But he had this kind of calmness. I mean, he wasn't your typical political activist. You know, he didn't try to convince you of anything. He didn't argue passionately about it. He was just very calm and incredibly certain about what he needed to do.
Do you understand what drove him?
I think my father loved Libya more than anything else. And I remember finding that very difficult at some point. I thought, you know, I felt jealous for the country. But he really did believe that Libya would not become the sort of country that he wanted if he didn't do his best at that. And also he didn't have an appetite for frivolity, and I think you need to have that in order to be distracted sometimes, no? I mean, he was very serious. He was a great deal of fun, too, and can be very funny, and he was a very warm presence, unlike the fathers in my books, who are very,
very distant,
cold and aloof. Yeah. I think I write about other fathers in order not to write about my father. But he, for example, he didn't suffer fools gladly, and he didn't try to convince you he's interested if he wasn't interested. So there are certain topics that bored him, such as business. People talk about work and money, and even though he was a businessman. Bored him.
And successful.
A very successful businessman. Bored him totally. He would just sort of start staring at the ceiling. We were very close. It was, we talked, you know, about, we had a lot of, we enjoyed debating with each other and talking about a lot of things. And his company was just exquisite.
The last time you spoke to and saw your father was early in 1990 when you were home on a break from your studies in England. And you were just 20 when he was kidnapped in March of that year. And again, the story sounds like something from a movie thriller or something, but it's real, unfortunately. Can you outline what happened, what you know and what you believe?
Well, my brother and I were attending university in London and my parents were in Cairo. And the Egyptian security services, the Mukhabarat, came and asked him to come with them for a little while and to collect his passport because they wanted to do some paperwork. And they were very genial. And so my parents weren't particularly concerned. And he went and he never came back. So my brother and I, of course, immediately went back to Cairo and we, with my mother, we would visit the Mukhabarat on a daily basis. Very strange people. You know, they were very opaque and they would give us, they would threaten us in indirect ways or fairly direct ways by saying things like, you know, if you, you know, the best thing that would guarantee his safety is if you remain quiet, if you make a fuss, then we can't guarantee what would happen to him. And they assured us that he's being kept in Egypt and that, you know, due to his vigorous opposition to Gaddafi and the new relationship that Egypt and Libya were beginning to have then, which was a more friendly relationship than before, you know, they can't not do anything about him. So they spoke in these kind of abstract terms. And we waited and waited and kept going back and eventually stopped going to them. And about 4 years into this, we get a letter that was smuggled out of Abu Slim prison, which is a very well-known, infamous prison and political prison in Tripoli. And it was written in my father's hand. It was signed by him. It had his cadence, nicknames that he used for us, his humor. It was definitely him. And it detailed exactly what had happened, that the day after he had been taken in March 1990, he was flown to Libya where he was tortured and imprisoned. And the document, I mean, we have three letters. He smuggled three letters, and one of them is actually a tape recording, his voice. And they're an amazing document because not only does he doesn't spare us the details, but you can hear in them and read in them this, that he was completely there. Everything was there. The poems that he loves, the anecdotes, the stories, the humor. And there are several things that my father is trying to do in these letters. He's trying to tell us what happened for the record and for history's sake. And he's trying to tell us personally how he feels and how he feels about being away from us, that he's really sorry for this. But he's also obviously giving us advice, my brother and I, and he is also doing something else, which is to liberate us from this situation. For example, in one place he says, don't grieve. Don't think of this as a misfortune. What happened to me is wonderful, because I was able to speak my mind. I was able to face a ruthless, oppressive dictatorship. Many people haven't been able to do that. Many people had to give in. And I don't think I would have been able to live with that. So I'm grateful for that. And I would do the same thing, even though I am sorry for the suffering that I've put you all through. But if I had it to do again, I would do exactly the same thing. But he was also doing something that I think all fathers, all good fathers have to do, which is to tell you, don't follow me. You'll have to find your own way. So don't take up my battle. And one of the ways he was doing that is he was asking each one of us about the things that he knew mattered to us most or mattered to us a great deal. And when it came to my turn, he said, "How's your poetry? Are you still writing poetry?" And I remember my heart just stopping for a fraction of a second when I first heard that was on the tape. Because I was worried what will come next. I was worried if he's going to say, "How's your poetry? Are you still writing poetry? Maybe you should do something more worthwhile." Instead, he said, "How's your poetry? Are you still writing poetry? I hope so." And suddenly this thing that I was obsessed with, that I thought, is this frivolous and in this time of great urgency that a 19, 20-year-old should be sitting down thinking about writing a poem while his father is being tortured and oppressed and so on. And all of this was a great gift, actually, so that he gave me exactly what I needed. I didn't even know I needed, but he knew.
Hisham Mata, your latest novel, The Anatomy of a Disappearance, begins with the statement, "There are times when my father's absence is as heavy as a child sitting on my chest." And that image, it's so startling. I mean, not just the oppressive weight of the father's absence, which is understandable, but comparing it to a child sitting on the chest of the son. I mean, to me, the image gives a clue to how mixed up the relationships are in this novel. Can you talk a bit about that, about the genesis of this story?
Well, it took about a year to arrive at that sentence, a year of writing and trying to make sense of the sort of book that I was interested in. And I started with what I can only describe as a feeling for Nuri, the protagonist and narrator. I felt very deeply towards him. I felt I could almost sort of have a sense of his presence. I don't know how he looks like, but I have a sense of what it would be like to be sitting next to him. That's all I had in the beginning. And I knew that one of the things I was really interested in is, can one ever know one's father? That it seems to exist this tragic distance of the generations, that it's impossible to be your father's equal, your father's friend. And therefore, because it's impossible to be their friend, there's a whole side of them that you don't know. You don't know what it's like to be their friend. What are they like when they are alone with their friends? And that seemed to be a very interesting thing to play with. And I also knew that what exaggerates this notion is the fact that the father disappears. And Nuri is unusual in the sense he is unusual to me. He is unlike me in that when my father disappeared, my reaction was to try to find him, find where he is. I'm still trying to put together the story. I'm still trying to find out where my father is. Whereas with Nuri, he does none of these things. And he does them a little bit, but not really. What he's more interested in is existentially finding his father. So he wonders what it's like to be his father, to stand in, you know, there's a part in the book where he sees a photograph of his father standing at a corner of a particular street, and he takes the photograph with him and he goes to that corner and he stands there in exactly the same spot, and he wonders whether people would think it's peculiar if he were to give them a camera and the photograph to replicate the exact photograph. And this is the way that he tries to find his father. And that seemed to be dramatically very interesting to me. And so a year of thinking and writing about the book, I arrived at that sentence, and that sentence seemed to have in it the DNA of the book and this interchangeable parent-child relationship where it's at some point, and I think we all go through this, that in some moments it is unclear who is the parent and who is the child, particularly when our parents get very old and we have to look after them.
As in your earlier novel, the various relationships in The Anatomy of a Disappearance are unusual and complicated. I mean, I think maybe even more so here. Mm. The young boy, the narrator, Nuri, his melancholy mother is dead. The father is mysteriously kidnapped. There's a dangerous attraction of his beautiful young stepmother, Mona. It's very tangled emotionally. Nuri somehow blames his father for his mother's death, and it's It's left ambiguous how she died. He blames himself for his father's disappearance. There's guilt and shame in his attachment to Mona. I mean, what interested you in this emotional minefield?
Oh, that sounds fantastic. I mean, in a way, it's an anti-Oedipal story. You know, it starts out, you think, this is okay, I know this territory. It's, you know, the father and the son fighting over the same woman who is, she's between them in age. She's actually 1 year closer to Nuri, which is why Nuri says, I have more claim on her.
And I saw her first.
And I saw her first. And, you know, he's obsessed with this beautiful, mysterious woman whom his father marries. You know, one of the things that the Oedipal story is about is that this boy who's born to privilege gets thrown out of the court, and he is, you know, eventually finds his way back to the court and becomes powerful and so on. And that's one of the things that the story is about. Of course, it's also about the stuff that we know about, which is that he killed his father and married his mother. But Nuri, in the sense that he is born into privilege, but he realizes throughout the book that he's actually an outsider, very much an outsider, that he is, you know, his mother isn't his mother, and that he has inherited this outsider reality that keeps him, I think, existentially always unstable. And that seemed to somehow feed the narrative for me.
Hisham Mata, you became an open critic of the Libyan dictatorship after your first novel came out in 2006. Was that inevitable?
I ask myself that. I'm not sure. I mean, I think if I were a different sort of person, maybe it would have been possible. I admire people who don't give in to the obligations imposed on them by history or by society, actually. You know, I don't advise it, you know. I don't advise doing what I did because it's very hard on a lot of things and it intrudes on this private space. You know, every interview I gave about my father and about human rights in Libya, it was like this gust that was blowing through the house. For days I'd feel unsettled and worried and anxious, not only about myself but about relatives and people that I know. But it seemed to me indecent, that it would be indecent of me not to say anything. And it also seemed necessary, and I felt that enough time had passed that my silence is either helping keep things the way they are, keep my father where he is, or if I speak, it, you know, he might be punished. And so I was between those two very difficult choices. And so in a way, having made up my mind and spoke out was a kind of relief. But then, of course, it exposes you to a set of extraordinary pressures that you have to be very attuned to. Suddenly people want you to be a spokesperson for them. And so you have to be able to resist it. Otherwise, I think society, it's in the DNA of society to try to destroy its artists, always, even against itself, even when they don't think they're doing it. There's something about the position of the artist, this person that stands outside of the march, who's observing the march, that provokes the march, and it upsets people.
And did you feel fearful for yourself? I mean, given that Gaddafi's men were able to carry out operations even outside Libya at the time.
No, very much. I'm not a brave person. I mean, I felt very afraid and anxious and observed. But I was also fearful almost as much, maybe even more, for that, not just my work, not my work as in a material sense, but the place from which this stuff comes from, the sort of silence and peace that it needs for me to do my work. That's what I was afraid of.
Libyan-British writer Hisham Attar in Toronto in 2011. His books, Anatomy of a Disappearance and In the Country of Men, are published by Penguin Random House. He has a new novel called My Friends.
Hi, I'm Caitlin Prest, and I am here in your ear to tell you about a very incredible new show called Asking for It. Asking for It is a darkly comedic series that follows a queer femme singer whose history of violence finds her no matter how many times she runs away. It has an original soundtrack, and it'll make you laugh, cry, and feel a little bit less alone. Asking for It. Subscribe now.
In October 2011, a few months after my conversation with Hisham Attar, Gaddafi was captured and killed, marking an end to his 40-year regime. But in the vacuum of power, militant groups flourished, leading to nearly a decade of war and international intervention. In 2012, 33 years after he left, Hisham Attar returned to Libya with his wife and mother to try to discover what exactly had happened to his father. The prison cells were empty, his uncles and cousins released, but no sign of his father. Attar wrote about this journey in his Pulitzer Prize-winning 2016 memoir, The Return, subtitled Fathers, Sons, and the Land in Between. It also won the Penn Jean Stein Award and the UK's Rathbones Folio Prize and was named one of the 10 best books of the year by the New York Times. Then, in 2020, in the aftermath of that wrenching investigation, he produced a different meditation on the relationship between history and art, grief and consolation. A month in Siena focused on the time he spent looking at paintings and walking the streets of this Tuscan town in Italy. Here's part of my conversation with Hisham Attar from the CBC's London studio in 2020. In March 2012, you returned to Libya with your wife and mother for the first time in 33 years. And that journey is the subject of your 2016 book called The Return, Fathers, Sons, and the Land in Between. Given all that had happened during your time away, you say in the book that you were wary of romanticizing the landscape of your homeland. But if anything, on first sight, it was, as you put it, more luminous than you remembered. How so? What did you see and feel on arriving there?
It was as though I felt a correspondence with it, you know? I felt I was being remembered by it. And that struck me very deeply, very powerfully. There is something about that landscape, about how luminous it is and how you have this meeting of largely, of course, not the whole country, but largely arid land with this magnificent sea, and you have 2,000 kilometers of contact with that sea, the Mediterranean. And something about that does something to the light that makes everything seem allegorical in some way. And of course, I was myself charged with a powerful combination of forces. You know, I was, on the one hand, eager to get on the ground and try to find what I can about my father. At the same time, very frightened to find out what happened to my father. And I was eager to see the people and the places that I love and haven't been able to see for 33 years. At the same time, worried about seeing them. Worried about whether by seeing them, the distance would be exposed even further and I'd feel even further away from them. And the landscape represented a kind of delight and some consolation because of this thing about feeling remembered by it, you know.
Because your younger self was waiting for you.
Yes, that's a lovely way of putting it, yeah. And I think our younger selves sometimes know much more than we think they know. I'm always amazed by that. By, you know, notwithstanding the general kind of confusion and stupidity by which one moves in the world, there is this sort of quiet, knowing self that starts with us right from the beginning. And, of course, we do a lot to drown it or to sometimes even destroy it. But, yes, that's a good way of putting it.
So I don't want go into too much detail here about all the places that you went to on your return to Libya, but I do want to ask about some of the more unexpected points of connection with your father that you discovered. You heard about a tragic and traumatic incident in his past, which was the violent death of his older brother. You knew nothing about that beforehand. What happened?
No, I didn't. Libya was, you know, one of the stages where both world wars were fought. And so it's a place that has a lot of mines, German, English, French. And so my father and his brother, who were very close, close in age and close in sensibilities, and they were friends, were playing out in the open. And the man that would have been my uncle, you know, stepped on a mine and died, and my father was right there to see it. So,
but isn't it strange that your father would never have mentioned it to you? That he must have been so profoundly affected by it.
Yeah, he must have been. He must have been. But I also feel with my father that there are other things that I don't know. You know, he was incredibly intimate and warm and loving and generous and gentle, but he doesn't, you know, he's old-fashioned, right? So he doesn't sort of disclose these things at the ready.
And you also came across some of your father's early creative writing, a surprise, you say, a gift sent back through time, a couple of short stories. And he was a writer, you say, responding to ghosts and history. Would you say that same of yourself?
Yes, I think on some level I do that. Maybe all writers do that. But he was very young when he wrote those stories. He was 17 or so. And they're pretty good for a 17-year-old. They're pretty good. And so it had this strange sort of double tide for me, where I felt I was getting closer to him, to his younger self, and also that I had somehow strangely become the father at that moment. I was certainly old enough to be his father. And I felt that I was a better writer than he was, and that I could help him. That I could give him, I could sort of help him edit it, or tell him what he might want to explore here, or what he might want to get rid of there. And I think I would have enjoyed that.
Although your relationship with your father, I mean, it continues in its way. And as you say in The Return, one of his gifts to you was his confidence.
Yes.
What does that mean for you?
He never said it, but it was more powerful than saying it, is he behaved in a way that he always made me think that what I was feeling and thinking was really worthwhile and was unique and of sort of a high value without indulging me. In fact, anything but that. But that's very powerful. That really gets to you. And you wonder, you know, whether he was what he most probably was, which is a biased, loving father, or whether he actually did see something. And that's a lovely thing to leave somebody with. And which is why I have a very tender, sympathetic place in my heart for the opposite, you know, for people I know very well whose fathers left them with the burden of disapproval or criticism, unfair criticism. So that stuff is very powerful.
Hisham Mattar, art, painting is the focus of your new book, A Month in Siena, but your attraction to specific works has led over the years to some compelling and maybe even uncanny correspondences with events in your own life. For instance, just a few days after your return from Libya, you found yourself in Rome studying a particular painting by Titian. Can you say what it was and why it spoke to you?
Yes, no, this has been a big part of my life, and it sort of has a strange correspondence with what happened to my father. I've always enjoyed, you know, going to museums and looking at paintings. Art has always been a part of my life. But when I was 19, which is when I lost my father,
in London, I lived very close to the National Gallery, and the National Gallery is free to enter, and this allowed me to go regularly. But I found it overwhelming. I couldn't do what most people do. I still can't, you know, where you go to a show and you go from one picture to the next, and I don't know, an hour later you're done and you go have a cup of tea or something. I just find that very difficult to do. And so I decided that I would look at one painting only for 10 minutes or 15 minutes and then leave. And I'll do that for the whole week with that one picture, and then I'll switch. And there are a couple of coincidences that were very powerful. There's one where on the day of the massacre in the political prison that my father was held in, which was in the summer of 1996, was the massacre, so 6 years from the date of his kidnapping. I read later, this is when I was writing the book, I wondered what I was doing on that day, given that that's the most likely date that my father died on. There's no proof, we don't know it.
This is when more than 1,200 prisoners were led into the courtyard of Libya's Abu Salim prison and executed.
Exactly, yeah, in one day. And I thought, where was I? What was I doing that day? And, well, I found in my diary, and I'm not a regular sort of diarist, but there was an entry for that date. And the entry went something like this. Couldn't get up till noon. Going back to NG, National Gallery. I think I'm done with the Velasquez. And I will turn to Maximilian. The Execution of Maximilian is a painting by Manet. And if you had to choose one painting in the National Gallery that would evoke the inconclusive fate of the men that died, the 1,200 men that died, that were killed that day, that would be the painting, because it's a painting that was, after Manet painted it, it was cut up into little pieces so people can sell parts of it. And then Degas, who was Manet's friend, collected all the pieces he could find, and the National Gallery put them together in the early 90s, I think it was 92, put them together. And so when you look at the painting, you'll see that parts of it are empty because, you know, Degas couldn't find all the parts. And so not least of all, Maximilian himself is you can't see him. You just see the firing squad, and you see one of his generals who was shot with him holding his hand. So it was, you know, that sort of coincidence was shocking and quite powerful for me.
It was after you finished your book about your return to Libya that you took yourself on a different kind of journey to a very different place, the Italian city of Siena in Tuscany. And your fascination with the Sienese school of painting began around the time you lost your father. How did you discover this work or come to such a deep appreciation of it?
I mean, one of the ways that I moved around the gallery is that I'd have a target, you know, and in those days, you know, I was interested in Velasquez and Manet and Cézanne and painters that felt, although, of course, mighty and distant, felt somehow reachable to me. I could sort of... I feel I understand some things about what Cézanne is doing. But with the Sienese school, there was something about those paintings that I felt were very distant from me, that they came from a faraway tradition and had a purpose to remind the faithful and, you know, to be part of their worship, that ordinarily would have made me just walk away from them because I didn't feel I had the tools to engage. But these Sienese paintings particularly got me in a way that I didn't quite understand, and I kept returning to them and looking at them. And when I finished the Return, which is a book that I felt was written out of my veins, you know, it was very an intense experience, and sometimes I even doubted whether it was good for me to take myself to these very dark places. So when I finished it, even though it hadn't been published, I felt released in some way from its demands. And I wanted to do something that attends to my pleasure. It's something I'm becoming more and more serious about. I think, you know, it's very good to be serious about one's civic responsibilities, but I think it's also very important to be serious about one's pleasures. And so I thought, what would give me pleasure? What would really delight me and give me pleasure? And I thought a month in Siena would, where I could finally be in that place that has produced these paintings that have perplexed and delighted and amazed me, really, for a quarter of a century.
And these paintings, I mean, they're from the 13th, 14th, 15th centuries. I mean, they're, as you say, they left me feeling unprepared and in need of translation. They stood alone. They're neither Byzantine nor of the Renaissance. What connection do you think you felt to them? I mean, how did they speak to you so directly?
Exactly because they do exist between chapters of busy artistic activity. You know, the waning influence of the Eastern Church in Italy, and before that incredible event or series of events that we somehow as a shorthand call the Renaissance. So they are in a place that didn't have the confidence that Florence had during the Renaissance, or Rome, or Venice. And so it was curious. It's actually, I don't mean this to upset my Tuscan friends, but it is exactly the opposite to modern-day Tuscany, you know, which is satisfied. It wants you to look at it and enjoy it. There's nothing that you can bring. It's got everything to to give you. But whereas then, it was a place that really believed, and these artists, Duccio, Lorenzetti, Simone Martini, and Giovanni Di Paolo, all of these great Sienese artists who were really working off one another, and you could see it in the paintings. They are actually, notwithstanding the religious, iconic kind of language that they all embody, they're mostly all of the Virgin Mary and baby Jesus, you know, they're mostly stories from the Bible. Notwithstanding that, their main preoccupation really is human life. So when Duccio paints the Virgin Mary and the baby Jesus, you can see that what he's really interested in is what does it really mean to be a mother? What is that really like? And to be that kind of mother, and to be a child and that kind of child, and what is the relationship between them? And so you feel that regardless of your faith, you feel that you are being involved in the rich drama of human life in them.
In A Month in Siena, you see art as hopeful.
Yes, yes. And I think the most maybe hopeful thing about a painting, particularly a great painting, is that you can see how in a concentrated space, someone who is, you know, very much like you and I, has captured something, or in some cases more than one thing, that is recognizable to us in some way. And I think in that, there is a recognition of a very basic fact, which is the correspondence between our lives, you know, the fact that we really have much more in common with one another than not. And so there's something about a great work of art that is dignifying in that sense.
Hisham Attar, I'd like to return for a moment to the subject of Libya, your troubled homeland, and having spent time there in 2012, reconnecting with your extended family. Do you remain engaged with the struggles there?
I mean, I keep up with what's happening. I keep in touch with my relatives. But I think the way we spend our time makes something of us. I think it really does matter where you live, actually, having now given you the impression that it doesn't matter. It actually does matter very much how you live and where you live and what you do with your time. And, you know, all of those have made something else of me. So I feel related, but I don't feel I'm from there in the same way. Yeah. And there's something about that that I welcome, you know, because for a long time, I felt like a satellite and the center was elsewhere, you know? And really, only in the last few years, I've been feeling that I am in the center of my life, for better or for worse. This is it. And there's something about that that I think also comes with age, you know, because I feel very strongly about this. I feel that we live in a time that fetishizes youth, you know, that sort of, it's as if the subtext is that to be an adult is a disaster, you know, it's a terrible event. But I find that these are really wonderful gifts that have come with middle age for me. You know, they're very rich, you know, the ability to find curiosity, to foster curiosity towards the things that used to overwhelm me or confuse me or baffle me. And also the feeling to feel in your place, not always, of course, but, you know, occasionally at least.
Because the time that you were there was, you know, not long after the Libyan Revolution of 2011. The country was, speaking of hope, was filled with hope. And you said you'd never been in a place so powerfully suspended between foreboding and optimism.
Yeah.
And now it just seems to have unraveled so badly.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's. I mean, I think that you need a kind of reckless madness to revolt. And that's why the Libyan Revolution was really quite an amazing event, because against all the odds, you know, the lack of institutions, the freedom to organize and control over all elements of culture, whether it's the press or the universities, it's amazing that those men and women went out and risked their lives and toppled a military dictatorship. It's quite an event. But then what it left the country with is it had to then deal with the rudimentary nature of the state that the dictatorship relied on. And that still remains the problem, that you have to not only overthrow the dictator, you have to overthrow the dictator and then build a state. And those two things are separate and both incredibly demanding, but I would say building a state is far more demanding. Plus, of course, the stuff that everybody knows, which is that Libya is an incredibly wealthy country in natural resources, and so it excites the parasitic appetites of otherwise reasonable countries, you know. Your neighbors, Europe, America, and so you end up with this proxy war that's happening. It's not a civil war. That's the wrong definition. Libya doesn't have a civil war. It has a proxy war, and it's terribly dangerous and very difficult to see a way out of it, because it's very difficult to convince all of those foreign players to pull back.
Do you feel a particular anguish in that? I mean, it was a country your father loved so much. I mean, there's this poignant line, a distressing line in The Return, where your family's trying to discourage your father from taking on too many risks, and he says, don't put yourselves in competition with Libya. You will always lose.
Yes.
It was a land he loved more than anything.
And he was committed, you know, to a cause, and very few people, you know, experience that, I think. You know, when you have a parent who is totally committed to a cause, and it will always be more important than everything else, including you. And that's, you know, that's complicated. and I think one of the things that I've been trying to do is that, I mean, I have a huge admiration of Freud. I think of him as a poet rather than a psychoanalyst. I think he's really marvelous. And like a poet, you know, one should take what he says in ways that aren't direct. But I always thought killing your father isn't really the way that you find liberation. And I've been trying in these books to find another way of doing it, where I would gain my own independence whilst attending to the history and engaging with it and taking it seriously, and at the same time taking my own interests seriously. My sensibility is very different from my father. You know, I'm interested in things in a different way than him. We were interested a lot in similar things, but in a radically different way. Like, political activists think they find the obstacle and they think, how do we get over the obstacle? For me, I'm not a political activist. I look at the obstacle and I'm interested in other questions, like what does the obstacle want? Why is the obstacle there? So that meant that a lot of my narrative, a lot of the things that I'm interested in, didn't have space. It was too much urgency, too much, you know, people disappearing, political violence, exile. There's just too much noise around to stop and look at a painting. And so to find a way where you could not so much reconcile these two things, but give them their equal due, you know, both of them, was one of the things that I was doing in the return.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much.
It's a wonderful pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Hisham Attar in London in February 2020. A Month in Siena and his memoir, The Return, are published by Penguin Random House. His new novel, My Friends, explores family, friendship, homeland, and political exile. For the first time, there is no figure of the absent father. After our conversation, later that year, in October 2020, a ceasefire was reached between Libya's UN-backed government forces, the Government of National Accord, and those of the rival administration, the Libyan National Army. Despite the truce, the country has settled into what's been described as chaotic stasis, and abuses have continued, including arbitrary detention, torture, and killings. Writers and Company was produced this week by senior producer Sandra Rabinovich. Katie Swales is also producer, with thanks to Olivia Pascarelli. You can also hear the program on our website. Just go to cbc.ca/writersandcompany. I'm Eleanor Wachtel. Next week, the British author of the popular Grantchester Mysteries series, James Runcie. His latest novel imagines the life of Johann Sebastian Bach through the year 1727 that he wrote the St. Matthew Passion. That's next week. I hope you'll join me.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.